books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, author Linda Marin joins us to talk about Last Chance in Paris. We'll hear about an RNIB short story writing competition for children to be judged by Michael Morpurgo. And as always, we find some brand new books in the RNIB library. All that and more on today's Read On. Last Chance in Paris is a funny, moving and above all, life-affirming story of a make-or-break trip to Paris by an Irish couple following a tragedy. It's the debut novel of prolific reader and bookstagrammer Linda Marin. And as we'll find out later on, the book has even been endorsed by President Bartlett himself, Martin Sheen. If you're listening to this on the day of release, the book came out yesterday in print, as an e-book, and in audio, as read by Emma Heatley.
Only an idiot would travel without a book. Only a fool, thought Claire, would prioritise clean knickers and kitten heels ahead of reading material in the great 10-kilogram baggage challenge. And yet, here she was, flipping from the front to the back of the flight safety card. It didn't even have words, only line drawings of people calmly flinging themselves out of planes. A woman standing in the aisle tugged theatrically on an oxygen mask, its disconnected tubing dangling loose at her hip. "If you're travelling with a child, secure your own mask first," she said. "Breathe normally." Watching from 6A, the window seat, Claire wondered how many parents obeyed that rule. When it came to it, when the plane was falling out of the sky, when alarms were ringing and hearts exploding, how many parents put on their own mask first? And did putting on their own mask first make them a better parent or a worse one? "In the event of an emergency, assume the brace position." The flight attendant was old school. Sensible court shoes, lacquered chignon, makeup guaranteed to survive a sea landing. Her name was Imelda, according to the name tag on her Kenmare green lapel. Imelda was not, Claire thought, a woman who would welcome philosophical questions from her audience.
The central characters of the book are an Irish couple, Ronan and Claire, who, you know, they're young, they're not long married, and they've just had an absolutely brutal year, as bad as things could go for them. And even though they both have the very best of intentions, they're having a really hard time holding their marriage together. And in an act of goodwill, Ronan decides to whisk Claire away for the weekend to go to Paris. She doesn't really want to go, but again, in an act of goodwill, she says, "Yeah, we'll try and make this work." So they go to Paris. But, you know, it's not all roses or anything. Neither of them are really expecting anything from it. And then the story unfolds in the way that they interact with various people that they meet on the streets of Paris, lots of really different, disparate characters that they meet, and how just really small acts of kindness between strangers on the street can change lives fundamentally.
It was the smell of the place that did it. Sure, there were announcements in French and French voices murmuring all around her, but it was the particular cocktail of smells, the warmth of dark roasted coffee beans and browned butter, the nose-tickling perfumes and the murky underlay of cigarette smoke, that made some signpost in Claire's brain swivel on its rusty hinges and point to Paris. It felt like walking through the back of the wardrobe, crossing the threshold to a place where expectations were different, or maybe gravity had just a fraction less pull. Anything might happen here, because the rules, at least some of them, didn't apply.
Yeah, there's lots of people in there, from a Hollywood producer to, Ukrainian refugees? How is you Ukrainian?
No, I don't have any Ukrainian. That involved a lot of research and a lot of help. I got in touch with a translation agency here in Cork, and I just asked them to help me with, and they were really lovely. They were really interested that, you know, that I was putting a Ukrainian character into my novel, and they couldn't have been more helpful. In fact, they really, you know, they kind of gave me the background on the sort of phrases that Ukrainians would genuinely use when they're saying goodbye to each other. And in that conversation that I had with that translator, it was actually really quite touching, you know, because he'd clearly said goodbye to someone. So that was an exploration of something I didn't know anything about. And the whole novel, in fact, for me, was an experiment, because I'd never written fiction at all before and I didn't know if I could. And that was probably, putting that Ukrainian character in was probably one of the riskiest things I did and one of the things I've worried most about and still worry about, to be honest with you.
Yeah, because I've read that you started writing this 20 years ago. Obviously, the crisis in Ukraine wasn't happening 20 years ago. So was that something you added quite late in the process?
Well, when I say that so really what happened 20 years ago was that my husband, we'd been married about 5 years, we were stone broke, and he was on a promise to bring me to Paris and he couldn't afford to. So he gave me a notebook and he wrote on the front of it, "For when I take you to Paris." And I started scribbling ideas and things into that notebook. But that would only have been really just, you know, bare bones ideas. And gradually little things got scribbled into it, so that by the time we went to Paris, it was more that I had become certain that I wanted to write a novel set in Paris than that I had started writing it. And then we had this amazing weekend for our 20th wedding anniversary. We finally went to Paris and had this incredible, incredible weekend where just flukish things happened and we ran into people, you know, more than once, and people were nice to us on the street. We were just charmed. It was lovely. And when we came back, I wrote it up for my husband more as a sort of a memoir, saying, you know, we finally went to Paris and it was great. And then what happened shortly after that was that a friend of mine from college from 30 years previously published an academic book, and I congratulated him on it. And he said, no, you know, fiction is the thing. Fiction is what I really want to do. And do you want to read the novel I'm working on? So I said, yeah, great. And he sent it to me and I started kind of working with him on it, saying, oh, you could, you know, maybe you could do this, maybe you could do that. And he obviously wasn't thrilled with the idea of me telling him what to do. So he insisted that I have some skin in the game, as it were. So I then started working on the memoir of the weekend in Paris that I had written, and initially sort of just changing the pronouns and then adding more characters into it. And we worked then together back and forth on each of our novels. But sadly, we were only a few months into that process when he had a cancer diagnosis. And at that point, we kind of started working more on his book than my book, because he was really desperate to get it finished. And then in September 2019, he actually died. His wife, 2 days after he died, phoned me and said that he wanted me to do the eulogy at his funeral, which is something that would have been an enormous challenge for me. I'd never have spoken anywhere publicly in any way at all. But I did it. It was in Cambridge, in a room full of the hoity-toityest academics you can imagine, in a stunning hall. And the fact that I got through that and that I did that just gave me this enormous boost in courage to go through with showing my writing to anyone. So that was when I got really, really serious, actually. And I sat down, and it didn't take me a huge amount of time after that. I just really kind of let loose and thought, when one of your friend group dies, you have this feeling that you have to do more, live a bit extra hard for them, and maybe be brave and do the things that they didn't get to do. So I really, really launched myself into it at that point, and I just did it.
Last year was a big year for Irish books. Is it easier to be a writer in Ireland?
I know that Paul Lynch and a lot of other writers have said that there is funding available here from the Arts Council. I certainly haven't got it. I haven't got any of it. I do think we have a really strong tradition of writing. But honestly, the thing that people don't really talk about that I think is very true is that our education system has a very strong emphasis on literature. Everyone here studies English and literature, you know, till they're 18, to really quite a high level. And I think that just has a natural effect that, you know, we're a nation of readers. We're also a nation of radio listeners. Apparently, Irish people listen to the radio more than any other country in the world. I think we like talking, really. We like talking. And we have a style of writing, especially at the moment, that is not, it's not highfalutin, it's not fancy. I think if you read Paul Lynch or Elaine Feeney, they're not trying to impress you with their writing. They're just trying to really get you into the story. And I think that's their strength. And it's something that's appreciated here, I think.
Anna Burns as well, I think, would fall into that.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. It's not trying to impress with the writing. It's just the emphasis is getting you into the story. And it works. The fact that that sort of writing is appreciated by people in the Irish Times and reviewers, it just helps give everyone, it just has sort of set up a whole way of writing that I think people in the rest of the world now have started noticing and appreciating.
So you finished the book. Did you approach agents?
I did. What happened was that I went to one of these events in the library in Cork City where it was a read your first chapter event and there were several agents there. And of course, I didn't have the courage to read my first chapter. I just sat in the background. But I saw an agent, Polly Nolan, and I just thought that she was amazing. And when she commented on other people's work, she had a way of saying things that I thought were absolutely right, but I'd never have thought of them myself. And I just thought that's the person you want on your team. So I wrote to four agents, but incredibly, she was the one who came back and said she wanted me. So I was absolutely thrilled. So I think that was September 22. And then I did some editing with her. I went back to Paris and did some fact checking. And then we went to publishers around about this time last year.
That's what I was going to ask. How many research trips to Paris did you make?
After we were, you know, in the process and the book was in the process, one weekend, and it was our 25th wedding anniversary. My poor husband, no one at that stage, none of the family or anyone knew that I was writing a novel. It was this secret thing. And all our family thought we were gone to Paris for this romantic 3 days. And in fact, my poor husband was carrying notebooks and pens around behind me while I checked what time the lights went off in the Eiffel Tower.
So the book came out yesterday, if you're listening to this on the day of release. The audio version is also read by Emma Headley. Have you heard any of the audio book?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard it yet. I have been sent a link, but it doesn't work yet. So you'll have heard it before I will.
Did you have any choice of who narrated the book?
No, to be honest, not really.
And was it something you ever considered doing yourself?
My French wouldn't have been up to it. I did briefly consider it, but no, my French accent would have made really more comedic value than anything else.
It wasn't very practical on the insufficient footpaths of Rue de Cherche Midi, with their backpacks bumping together and homebound Parisians clipping past on either side, but Claire and Ronan were walking with their arms wrapped around each other's hips. "We could just keep walking," Claire said, "like Jessie and Celine in Before Sunset." "I'm getting peckish. Did Jessie and Celine ever stop to eat?" "Life's hard, Ro. It's meant to be." She leaned her hip into his. "Are you quoting Ethan Hawke again?" She felt his grip tighten possessively. She laughed. "I wouldn't dare." He squeezed her waist. She lifted her chin and gave him a flirting grin. Across the street, a queue of coiffed ladies stood quietly outside a bakery. Directly opposite was a small stationery shop, une papeterie, with an irresistibly quaint window display. They split up. By the time Claire had chosen a notebook, a bookmark, and a fridge magnet of Mona Lisa with the face of a cat, Ronan was standing outside the shop window, looking miserable. "Let me guess," Claire said. "They're all out of almond croissants." "Worse." "What?" "I can't find my wallet."
Now, looking you up on your Instagram, what's your Instagram name?
Sultana Bun. I was trying to come up with a username for, I think it was like an Amazon account or something, and everything I put in was taken already, and I was getting really frustrated. And I said to my husband, "I can't think of anything." And he said, "You just look up and name something that you see." So I had a Sultana Bun on a plate in front of me, and I put in Sultana Bun. No one had thought of that before. And it stuck. So I stuck with it. Yeah.
But your Instagram is wall-to-wall books. It's fair to say you're quite a voracious reader.
I am. Yeah, I am. I always have been. I guess I'm quite an anxious person. I have a lot of, I have a busy head. I have a busy head and a hard time quietening it. And the only thing that really, well, two things now that work for me. The first is reading, which I've done all my life, and writing. But yeah, reading is just how I still my mind. And I just love it. Yeah, I absolutely love it. I think maybe I've always tried to figure out how, you know, some people are good readers or why some children are good readers. And I'm never quite sure. But I think maybe it's people who can just visualize the whole story in their head. And I really do. When I read a book, I live the book. I'm all the way in there and I don't get distracted. So I guess that's how I fly through them.
Is it always print or do you listen to audiobooks?
It's mostly print for me. Yeah, it is. I read a lot of audiobooks during lockdown when I was out walking. That was fantastic. That was really useful. But sitting in the house, no, I like turning the pages. I do. To be honest.
But now the book is narrated by Emma Headley. It's available to anyone who, for whatever reason, doesn't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you, that it's accessible to everyone?
Oh, God, absolutely. Yeah, no. No, I mean, like, there was no point in me lying and saying that I prefer audiobooks over print. I like print. Well, for me, it's actually really, really strange to hear someone else reading my words. But for me, The reading out loud thing for me is something that I've always associated as something I give more than something I receive. So I have read out loud for years, for 25 years now, to my children. And it is really an act of love. I genuinely, it's one of the most important things I've done. It's something that I was religious about. Like when my first son, time he was a tiny tot, but I remember a deliberate decision to give up watching soaps on TV because it was the one thing that might have stopped me from doing his reading at bedtime. So for me, the reading of a book has been something that I've given more than I've received, but I absolutely cherish the idea of someone sitting in a room listening to my words being read to them. That is just something so incredibly special to me as an author that I've hardly been able to bear thinking about it, to be honest, because it really is a special thing for me.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you describe the cover for us?
I can. So it is a bright and rather striking turquoise background with my name, Linda Marin, up the top, and been in a dark blue, and beneath that the title Last Chance in Paris in white. And then the bottom half of the cover shows the central characters, Claire and Ronan, sitting on a bench with their backs towards us, and they're a few centimetres apart with a little bit of sort of tension between them. And in the distance, they're looking at Notre Dame Cathedral. In the far distance, there's, you know, some scenic background, the Eiffel Tower and some trees. And most importantly, down in the bottom right hand corner, there are four words in red. "Frankly, it is wonderful," from Martin Sheen, the president.
I was going to mention that. I know he sent you a note when he was halfway through reading the book. How did you get Martin Sheen to give you a cover quote?
I know. And, you know, no one asks, because I think people think that he's my sort of Irish cousin or something, that I'm only pretending it's the real Martin Sheen. So what happened if I go back to my friend Finbar, who did all the writing with me, when he was ill in hospital, you know, I was sending him books of poetry and boxes of chocolates and boxes of biscuits and things, but you run out of things to send, and I couldn't think of anything more. And one day he told me he didn't have the energy to write anymore, and he was reading the West Wing scripts, which was something he was just fanatical about, absolutely fanatical. He was into politics, he loved America, he'd been to the Kennedy School, and he was just a wing nut, as they call them. So I had this note and I said, look, I'll just try it. So quietly in my own time, I did some Googling and I found an address for a production company. And I sent a long and heartfelt letter to Martin Sheen, telling him all about my friend and, you know, what we'd done together and his situation. And honest God, by return of post, within 5 days, a parcel came with a huge studio photograph of President Bartlett, signed President Bartlett, signed Martin Sheen, and a 5-page handwritten letter on headed notepaper from Martin Sheen to Finbar, and another little note to me, big bundle of stuff, which I then forwarded on to Finn and his family. And it was just this really, really beautiful thing. It came only days before he died, and it just gave everyone a lift. It was a beautiful letter in itself, but also the fun of it, you know, when the days were really, really dark. It was just a great thing. And afterwards, I wrote to thank him. And he kept writing. He wrote back. So we're sort of pen pals, Martin Sheen and I, just a little bit. And then when, he, you know, I had written to him early on about the fact that we were both writing books and all of that. And then when I had the book almost finished, I wrote him and I said, you know, would you like to read it? And incredibly, he wrote back, absolutely, of course. So before anyone had read it, I printed off a copy from my computer with, you know, it wasn't proofread, it had all the mistakes and everything, it was terrible. And I stuck it in a binder and put it in the post to Martin Sheen, gave the man in the post office, the local post office, a great laugh when he saw who the parcel was addressed to. Yeah, so the first thing that came back, which I found highly amusing, it was a bit, you know, it's all just post. We have no internet relationship, Martin Sheen and I, it's snail mail only. So the first thing that arrived into my post box a few weeks later was, you know, a little card with all the stars and stripes stamps on it. And I opened it up all excited and it just said, sorry about the delay. I'm halfway through and so far so good. Which I thought, can we put that on the cover? I mean, that's just the best thing you could possibly put on a cover. So far, so good. And then only a couple of days after that, he sent a 2 foolscap pages, critical enough review of the whole thing, what he liked, what he didn't like, but very kind, as he always is, and very generous. He's a great writer. He has a lovely turn of phrase and beautiful handwriting. And obviously that letter is a precious, precious thing.
As endorsed by President Bartlett himself, Last Chance in Paris by Linda Marin is out now in print as an ebook and in audio as read by Emma Heatley. And Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Linda will be back at the end of the show with the books of her life. But now, let's take a visit to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are 2 new gems. First this week, we have the new book by best-selling author Victoria Hislop, The Figurine, which was donated by Headline.
Helena stood at the top of the aircraft steps, blinking into the sunlight, a hot breeze blowing strands of hair across her face. Why was everything shimmering? So dazzlingly bright. Pame mikri, said the air hostess, holding her hand tightly as they descended onto the melting tarmac. Let's go, little one.
Of all the ancient art that captures the imagination, none is more appealing than the Cycladic figurine. An air of mystery swirls around these statuettes from the Bronze Age, and they're highly sought after by collectors and looters alike. When Helena inherits her grandparents' apartment in Athens, She's overwhelmed with memories of the summers she spent there as a child when Greece was under a brutal military dictatorship. Her remote, cruel grandfather was one of the regime's generals, and as she sifts through the dusty rooms, Helena discovers an array of valuable objects and antiquities. How did her grandfather amass such a trove? What human price was paid for them? Helena's desire to find answers about her heritage dovetails with a growing curiosity for archaeology, ignited by a summer spent with volunteers on a dig on an Aegean island.
At passport control, Helena's airline auntie showed the child's stiff new passport to an official before taking her to retrieve her brown plastic suitcase from the carousel. Helena was then handed over to a driver who was parked directly outside the exit. As they approached the large black car, she noticed a silver statuette perched on the front of the bonnet, a shiny winged lady. The 50-minute drive took her along the sea, so blue, so calm, and then into a network of busy, colourful streets, where she wound up her window to keep out the fumes. Twice, when the car had to stop because of the traffic, a few children clustered round and peered in to look at her, and she shrank back into her seat, embarrassed. In another street, someone approached selling flowers. Everything seemed exotic and strange, the buildings tall, the roads narrow. Finally, in an area where there were fewer people, much fancier dress shops and more trees, they stopped outside an elegant apartment block. "Edo imaste," said the chauffeur, speaking for the first time. "We're here."
The Figurine by Victoria Hislop is read by Rose Aykroyd and runs for 17 hours, 3 minutes.
There are many tales now telling the Greek myths from a female perspective. This is one of the latest. Ariadne by Jennifer Saint was donated by Wildfar from the Hachette Group.
I am Ariadne, Princess of Crete. Though my story takes us a long way from the rocky shores of my home, my father, Minos, liked to tell me that story of how his unimpeachable moral conduct won him Megara, the subservience of Athens, and the chance to set a shining example of his impeccable judgment.
Ariadne, Princess of Crete, and daughter of the fearsome King Minos, grows up hearing stories of gods and heroes. But beneath the golden palace something else stirs, the hoofbeats and bellows echoing from the labyrinth below. Every year its captive, the Minotaur, Ariadne's brother, demands blood. When Theseus, Prince of Athens, arrives as a sacrifice to the beast, Ariadne sees in him her chance to escape. But helping Theseus kill the monster means betraying her family and country, and Ariadne knows only too well that drawing the attention of the mercurial gods may cost her everything. In a world where women are nothing more than the pawns of powerful men, will Ariadne's decision to risk everything for love ensure her happy ending? Or will she find herself sacrificed for her lover's ambition?
Stories told that, at the moment of her drowning, Scylla was transformed into a seabird. Far from giving her release from her cruel fate, she was immediately set upon in an endless chase by the crimson-streaked eagle, bent upon eternal vengeance. I could well believe the truth of it, for the gods did enjoy a prolonged spectacle of pain. But when I thought of Scylla, I thought of the foolish and all too human girl, gasping for breath amidst the froth of waves, churning in the wake of my father's boat. I saw her weighed down in the tumultuous water, not just by the iron chains in which my father had bound her, but also by the terrible truth that she had sacrificed everything she knew for a love as ephemeral and transient as the rainbows that glimmered through the sea spray.
Ariadne by Jennifer Saint is read by Kirsten Atherton and runs for 13 hours, 43 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
We'll be back in the library in a moment, but first, Amelia Hilton has some news about an RNIB children's writing competition.
To celebrate World Book Day on the 7th of March 2024, RNIB is inviting blind and partially sighted children aged 5 to 12 to submit a short story for their competition. The submissions must be on the theme of adventure and will be judged by award-winning children's writer Sir Michael Morpurgo. Today, we're joined by Libraries Engagement Manager for RNIB, Lara Marshall, to learn more. Hi Lara, so can you give us some background on World Book Day and why it's such a key day for RNIB?
Absolutely. I mean, World Book Day now has been running for over 20 years and really celebrates reading, love of reading, the huge plethora of benefits that reading gives you, and especially as a young person early on in your life, all of the things it teaches you. Empathy, connection, different parts of the world, new experiences. And we want to make sure that children who are blind and partially sighted are included in this, and they have as many options and opportunity as the rest of the children who celebrate and participate in World Book Day. And that's why we've been working with the charity for a number of years to make sure that all of the books that children would get for free in print are available in audio braille and large print, or whatever the child's preferred format is.
And why is the theme adventure for this competition?
So we were lucky enough to partner up with Michael Morpurgo, who is huge, one of the most popular children's authors of all time. And his children's books generally go along the theme of adventure. We also wanted blind and partially sighted children to not feel limited in their story, but to think of an adventure that they could go on, something that inspires creativity and that Michael Morpurgo will really love to read. So we do have some suggestions. As we understand, you know, the competition is for 5 to 12 year olds, so it may be a bit tricky just thinking about any adventure. So we do have some suggestions for them as well. They can think about maybe a crazy dream they had, travelling somewhere new on holiday, finding an interesting artefact, or getting lost in a place you'd never been before. So they do have, you know, those suggestions to hopefully spark some ideas.
And you mentioned the submissions being read by Sir Michael Morpurgo. What are some of the other reasons people should take part?
I mean, just being able to partner up with such a hugely prolific and influential children's author is something that we're really proud of. And he is a real advocate for reading and making reading and writing more accessible. So definitely partake because of that. But also, you know, it's a great opportunity just to try something out, try something new. We are accepting all stories up to 500 words in a variety of formats. So you could actually record a video of yourself reading your story. You could submit it as a voice note or an audio file. And we are also now accepting hard copy braille submissions as well. So we asked for these to be sent to our London office in Grimaldi, and these will also be considered for the competition too. So it's a real chance to try something new, get creative, get those brain cells going, and of course the winner does win a set of Michael Morpurgo's books in their preferred format. So whether that be braille, audio, or large or giant print.
And you mentioned some of the rules. So 500 words in a variety of formats. People need to be 5 to 12. Are there any other key rules that people should know about?
So you can't type adventure story into ChatGPT. That's not allowed. Has to be completely original, completely from you. We're asking for one submission per person. because it is a national competition. So just one per person, please. And the deadline is midnight, the 18th of February. And then we will go through, they'll be read, they'll be judged. And yeah, we will be announcing the winner on the week of World Book Day. So good luck to everyone entering. And yeah, it would be wonderful to receive all your submissions.
And where can people get more information and send their submissions?
So on the RNIB website, they can go to rnib.org.uk/reading services/writing competition. Otherwise, go to the RNIB website, just type in writing competition. That should give you more information. Or there is my personal email address. All the entries will be coming to me. So if you have any questions, do feel free to contact me. And that is Lara, L-A-R-A dot Marshall, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L at rnib.org.uk.
And if writers want to get some inspiration and read some adventure stories, how can they do that?
They can do that by going to the RNIB library. So you can join on the RNIB website, or you can call our helpline and join for free to be able to access any book that is on the catalogue in your preferred format. We have the majority of Michael Morpurgo's books on there, as well as a vast amount of other adventure books for your inspiration.
Well, thank you so much, Lara Marshall, RNIB Libraries Engagement Manager, for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy
a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports talking books.
This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk.
For those who enjoy non-fiction, we have Eject, Eject by John Nicol, which was gifted by Simon & Schuster.
Thanks to the Pathé News films showing in Britain's cinemas, which enthusiastically reported their exploits to soundtracks of stirring patriotic music and clipped vowel voiceovers, a handful of test pilots had become household names, not unlike the first generation of astronauts or the Premier League footballers of the next millennium. They were an elite band, responsible for taking aircraft of the future to their absolute limits of speed, altitude and manoeuvrability, to evaluate the performance of man and machine under extreme stress.
Nicol tells the remarkable tale of how the ejection seat was first conceived during the Second World War, as countless lives were lost in accidents and in battle. In the wake of the war, that technological race to save aircrew lives using explosive seats continued at an incredible pace. Nicol tells the story of the brave men who risked their lives testing those early devices and interviewed the first British pilot to eject back in 1949, when ejection from pulling the handle to being under the parachute took 30 seconds. Today that figure is down to around 1 second. Packed with interviews from aircrew who knew exactly how it feels to bang out from an aircraft at high speed, both in peace and in war, the book gives the reader a vivid sense of what that life-saving experience feels like, but also features the moving accounts of what happens next from the viewpoint of both the crews and their families, who often have little or no information about whether or not their loved ones have survived, because ejecting is just the start of a journey.
I knew that a handful of brave chaps had made a couple of successful trial ejections from other aircraft in cold blood tests, but we'd not heard of a single one deployed in a genuine emergency. We had very little information about them, and I was very sceptical about the whole damn thing. Despite his misgivings, Joe sat down and then fastened the two sets of straps around his shoulders and thighs, one for his personal parachute and the other to anchor himself in position on the seat itself. In an emergency, the seat and Joe could now be blasted out of the jet together. The integral thigh guards should prevent his legs from being ripped apart on exit.
Eject, Eject by John Nicol is read by Thomas Judd and runs for 16 hours, 21 minutes.
If you enjoy a good psychological thriller, we have The Last Resort by Heidi Parks, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
Like every other trauma nurse, Raina is dead on her feet. She's been on them for the entirety of her shift and has clocked up another 23,000 steps. She had been ready to leave, but still, the adrenaline hits her, as it always does. It's what keeps her going, even at 1:30 a.m. on a Sunday morning. She races over to the main doors of emergency in time for the ambulance to pull up. The doors swing open, and there's a flurry of activity to lift the stretcher out. Raina glimpses the woman's face as she's rushed past. She's in a neck collar, intubated, like the paramedic told her. She'll be taken for a CT scan straight away, so the doctors know what they're dealing with. Raina holds back for the police officer, who arrives within minutes. "I'm a nurse in resus," she tells him, as she leads the way. He'll stay with the patient so that he has eyes on her. Then he will want to talk to the family when they get here.
Two people, two sides of the story. Whose do you trust? When Erin and Will start having couples therapy, they hope it will fix the rift that has appeared out of nowhere in their marriage. But their therapist, Maggie, can't work out whose version of the truth she can trust. Then Erin is brought into hospital in a critical condition following a hit-and-run accident. Now everyone is desperate to unravel the truth, because if this isn't an accident, then someone close to Erin must be responsible.
Odd one, this, he tells her as they scurry along the corridor. Looks like a hit and run, but God knows what she was doing out in the middle of nowhere on foot. Hopefully someone will have some idea. He waits by the doors to resus. He can ask his questions when the family gets here. In these precious moments, Raina knows the woman is a body to be worked on, to be cared for, a life to be saved. She shouldn't let thoughts of who the patient is, what family she has waiting for her, or whether they even know yet, catch her off track. But for Raina, that always comes sooner or later.
The Last Resort by Heidi Parks is read by Lucy Price-Lewis and runs for 9 hours, 29 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And finally on today's show, a return to the author of Last Chance in Paris, Linda Marin, for the books of her life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, absolutely, that made me fall in love with reading was Charlotte's Web by E.B. White. I just think it is the most perfect book, not just for children, but for anyone. And for anyone, I mean, it made me fall in love with reading, but looking back on it, I don't think you could find a better written book in any genre for any audience. I just think it's the most beautiful thing. And actually, I also think it is the most wonderful audiobook you can imagine. The audiobook is read by E.B. White himself, which must be a pretty early example, I think, of an author reading their own audiobook. And he has this beautiful, soft American accent that's warm and gorgeous. And I could just listen to it all day. We used to have the CD in the car when my kids were small. And when we were going on our holidays, it was just routine. Charlotte's Web went in, and that got us as far as we needed to go always. It's a funny book because even though it's absolutely a children's book, it's not in any way a YA book. It's absolutely for small children. The main character, Fern, is only 8. But the first line is, "Where's Papa going with that axe?" It's like the jeopardy that's set up immediately is just incredible. And the themes are, you know, hard. It's life and death stuff. And I just think it's one of the most powerful, beautiful books there is.
One afternoon in June, when Wilbur was almost 2 months old, he wandered out into his small yard outside the barn. Fern had not arrived for her usual visit. Wilbur stood in the sun, feeling lonely and bored. "There's never anything to do around here," he thought. He walked slowly to his food trough and sniffed to see if anything had been overlooked at lunch. He found a small strip of potato skin and ate it. His back itched, so he leaned against the fence and rubbed against the boards. When he tired of this, he walked indoors, climbed to the top of the manure pile, and sat down. He didn't feel like going to sleep. He didn't feel like digging. He was tired of standing still, tired of lying down. "I'm less than 2 months old, and I'm tired of living," he said. He walked out to the yard again. "When I'm out here," he said, "there's no place to go but in. When I'm indoors, there's no place to go but out in the yard." "That's where you're wrong, my friend," said a voice. Wilbur looked through the fence and saw the goose standing there. "You don't have to stay in that dirty little yard," said the goose, who talked rather fast. "One of the boards is loose. Push on it, push on it, and come on out." "What?" said Wilbur. "Say it slower." At the risk of repeating myself," said the goose, "I suggest that you come on out. It's wonderful out here." "Did you say a board was loose?" That I did, said the goose. Wilbur walked up to the fence and saw that the goose was right. One board was loose. He put his head down, shut his eyes, and pushed. The board gave way. In a minute, he had squeezed through the fence and was standing in the long grass outside his yard. The goose chuckled. "How does it feel to be free?" she asked. "I like it," said Wilbur. "That is, I guess I like it." Actually, Wilbur felt queer to be outside his fence, with nothing between him and the big world. "Where do you think I'd better go?" Anywhere you like, said the goose. "Go down through the orchard, root up the sod, go down through the garden, dig up the radishes, root up everything, eat grass, look for corn, look for oats, run all over, skip and dance, jump and prance, go down through the orchard and stroll in the woods. The world is a wonderful place when you're young."
That's Charlotte's Web, written and performed by E.B. White, which is available commercially. The version of Charlotte's Web, available from the RNIB Talking Books Library, is read by Liza Ross. And is there a book on a rainy day you like to curl up with and reread?
Right, well, I am not a great rereader because I tend to plough on to the next thing all the time. I'm always wondering what's coming next. But the book I would certainly recommend for a rainy day, and it is an extremely rainy day here in the south of Ireland today, is called Plainsong by Kent Harriff. Again, another American writer. And this is a small town story set in a fictional small town of Holt in Colorado in America. It's about lots of ordinary people. There's a father who's raising two boys by himself, and then there are the two boys, 9 and 10 year olds. And then there's a very young girl who finds herself pregnant and her mother throws her out of the house. And most wonderful of all is this pair of bachelor farmers, Harold and Raymond, who take in the young pregnant girl just because she has nowhere else to go. they're the most unlikely family you could possibly imagine, and it just turns into this really, really beautiful relationship. And the writing is very straightforward, no bells or whistles, but it just cuts straight to your heart. It's kind of warm. It's actually a bit like, it's like E.B. White for grown-ups, I think, in that the themes are more grown-up, but the writing and the style is similarly warm and kind and generous and just beautiful. And I guarantee you, you sit down with this on a bad weather day, you'll feel better at the end.
Guthrie brought two thick crockery plates of steaming eggs and buttered toast to the table and set them down. And the boy spread jelly on the toast and began to eat at once, automatically, chewing, leaning forward over their plates. He carried two glasses of milk to the table. He stood over the table watching the meat. "I have to go to school early this morning," he said. "I'll be leaving in a minute." "Aren't you going to eat breakfast with us?" Ike said. He stopped chewing momentarily and looked up. "I can't this morning." He recrossed the room and set the skillet in the sink and ran water into it. "Why do you have to go to school so early?" "I have to see Lloyd Crowder about somebody."
"Who is it?"
"A boy in American history."
"What'd he do?" Bobby said. "Look off somebody's paper?"
"Not yet. I don't doubt that'll be next the way he's going." Ike picked at something in his eggs and put it at the rim of his plate. He looked up again.
"But, Dad," he said.
"What?"
"Isn't Mother coming down today either?"
"I don't know," Guthrie said. "I can't say what she'll do, but you shouldn't worry. And try not to. It'll be all right. It doesn't have anything to do with you." He looked at them closely. They'd stopped eating altogether and were staring out the window toward the barn and corral, where the two horses were. "You better go on," he said. "By the time you get done with your papers, you'll be late for school." He went upstairs once more. In the bedroom, he removed a sweater from the chest of drawers and put it on and went down the hall and stopped in front of the closed door. He stood listening, but there was no sound from inside. When he stepped into the room, it was almost dark, with a feeling of being hushed and forbidding, as in the sanctuary of an empty church after the funeral of a woman who had died too soon. A sudden impression of static air and unnatural quiet. The shades on the two windows were drawn down completely to the sill. He stood looking at her, Ella, who lay in bed with her eyes closed. He could just make out her face in the half-light, her face as pale as schoolhouse chalk, and her fair hair massed and untended, fallen over her cheeks and thin neck, hiding that much of her. Looking at her, he couldn't say if she was asleep or not, but he believed she wasn't. He believed she was only waiting to hear what he had come in for, and then for him to leave. "Do you want anything?" he said. She didn't bother to open her eyes. He waited. He looked around the room. She hadn't yet changed the chrysanthemums in the vase on the chest of drawers, and there was an odor rising from the stale water in the vase. He wondered that she didn't smell it. What was she thinking about?
That's Tom Steschult reading from Plain Song by Kent Harroff, available commercially. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind and you'd like to recommend.
Yes, there is. So the book that I have read recently, I think it came out last year. It's called Soldier Sailor by Claire Kilroy. I met Claire Kilroy actually at the Dingle Literary Festival in November, and she was talking about how difficult it is for women with children to find time to write. It's kind of that age-old thing that Virginia Woolf talked about. And Claire Kilroy was a really bright, up-and-coming star writer in Ireland about 12, 13 years ago. And then she had her son and couldn't find the time or the space to write. And then she brought this novel out last year. And it really, it's about early motherhood. It's about becoming a mother. It's about the relationship between a woman and their first child. It's that, you know, all-encompassing, overwhelming love that you feel. And then also about the knowledge that you have that, you know, a relationship with the baby isn't going to last. They're going to grow up. It's going to change. And they don't know it, but you do know it. And it's sort of huge emotions. It is a very hard-hitting book, but then she also has these just moments of absolute hilarity. It's very, very funny, very self-effacing humour. And to be honest with you, you know, Irish books had a great year last year, but I really feel this one got a little bit lost under all the fuss about all our Booker nominees and all the rest of it. And I thought it should have got a lot more attention. It's a brilliant, brilliant book.
By the time darkness falls, I can't face my old enemy, the stairs. I slouch there, trying to summon the wherewithal. Yet every night, no matter how wrecked I am, I gaze at your sleeping face. Yes, yes, I know. We scream at each other from morning to night, but my love for you swells its banks while you sleep. I murmur it to your sleeping body, which is no good to you, but still, here I sit. Have you any idea of your beauty? Photos never quite capture it. I am worried that one day we won't speak. It happens all the time. You'll turn around someday and blame me for everything. Things that haven't happened yet will be my fault. What I have done and what I have failed to do. And I ask this, that we will always talk. Don't cut me out of your life. One day you will leave, and that is as it should be. Part of me cannot wait. And then there's this part. I dreamt that our names were carved upon a stone anchor for all eternity. And in a way, they are. It is late, and I am tired. There are things I must tell you. Bad things, dark things, things I have concealed. Your trust is so blind that it hurts. I almost left you once. A bad confession is worse than none at all. I did leave you. There you were, all alone. The wrongness of this image rears up at me at off-guard moments. When I'm rinsing a cup or putting on a wash, you just lying there with your perfect skin. I wasn't myself. Still haven't.
Soldier Sailor by Claire Kilroy is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Simone Collins. And Linda, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.